Welcome, everyone, to this podcast about applied behavior analysis and its application by speech language pathologists. My name is Marila Koenig. I am a soon to be retired professor and clinical supervisor at Westchester University. And I am joined by four colleagues who are also SLPs and behavior analysts. I'm going to begin by asking each of them to introduce themselves to you. So, Nikia.
My name is Nikia Dower. I'm a speech pathologist and a board-certified behavior analyst. I am the owner of Dower & Associates, a private practice in Virginia that provides speech and language services for pediatric and adolescent individuals. I also am the current president of the Speech Pathology Applied Behavior Analysis Special Interest Group within the Association of Behavior Analysis International.
Thank you, Nikia. Heather?
Well, hello. My name is Heather Forbes. I'm also a speech language pathologist and a board certified behavior analyst. I am also an assistant professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders. I also had previous experience before that as a consultant with Patton's Autism Initiative, and that's where I provided ABA-based communication programming and services consultation for students with autism in public schools.
Thank you, Heather. Joanne?
Hi, everybody. My name is Joanne Gerenzer. I'm currently the executive director of the EDEN 2 programs. We are a multi-service organization serving children as young as three all the way through adulthood. When I began there in 1982, I started as a speech language pathologist. Given that it was an ABA program, I quickly became a behavior analyst in my practice. I never actually sat for the exam, so I'm not a board certified behavior analyst, but I've been practicing behavior analysis for over 40 years. And I'm also a founder and board member of the Council of Autism Service Providers.
Thank you, Joanne. Tammy?
I'm Tammy Casper, and I'm another dually certified SLP and BCBA. They call us unicorns, and I kind of like that. I'm director owner of Casper Enterprises and a consultant to the Clinical Center of Excellence for a company called Caravelle Autism Health. And I worked for about 12 years as a SLP before I became a behavior analyst. And during that time, I got to work in a variety of different settings, a residential school, birth to three, a pediatric clinic, an elementary school. I was a university instructor. And then when I learned about ABA, I became a consultant under Vince Carbone, who was kind of a big deal at that time and still is in terms of applied verbal behavior. And through a connection with him, I was able to travel worldwide disseminating applied verbal behavior, specialized kind of teaching procedures in behavior analysis. And the other part of that mission was to promote collaboration between SLPs and BCBAs. And that's what I also did at my clinic that I had for 15 years, where we took clients who were really emergent communicators, kids who were struggling to learn how to speak. And really our focus was on ABA with a strong emphasis on improving speech.
Thank you, everyone. So as you can see, there's a wide range of expertise around this table. We're all speech language pathologists who value the science of ABA, but apply it in different settings. Through our experiences in the larger context of service delivery, we've become aware of considerable misinformation about ABA, often communicated by individuals without a background in the field. So our goal for producing this podcast is to provide some clarity. We're going to do that by defining applied behavior analysis, describing its application in different contexts, sharing with you how ABA has enhanced our SLP skill set, giving you information about ABA certification, and describing SPABA, the Special Interest Group for Speech Language Pathologists in the World of Applied Behavior Analysis. We believe that a better understanding of ABA will support interdisciplinary collaborative practice between SLPs and ABA professionals, and maybe that some of you will be inspired to pursue certification in ABA yourselves. So let's begin. Heather, tell us about ABA.
Sure. Well, first of all, that's a loaded question. It's a big question about what is ABA, but I also think it's a very important question. First of all, I don't know if we just talked about this, but ABA stands for Applied Behavior Analysis. I like to describe it as the science of teaching and learning. So that science consists of principles that describe how individuals learn, and then it involves applying those principles to teach skills that improve quality of life. So that's what the applied means in applied behavior analysis. We apply behavioral learning principles in order to improve quality of life. Now, for the most part, those learning principles exist in what we call the operant framework. It's also called the ABC framework, where A stands for antecedent, and that's what happens immediately before a behavior occurs. B stands for behavior, and so the behavior is anything someone does. And then C stands for consequence. So that's what happens, or anything that happens immediately after a behavior occurs. Now, the basic gist is that learning occurs based on what happens before and after the behavior. So we can consider antecedents, those A's, as events that trigger the behavior to occur. So for example, we might see a doorknob and we want to go outside to our car. And those antecedents, seeing the doorknob and wanting to go outside to the car, that triggers the behavior in us of turning the doorknob. And then we have those consequences, or the C's. Those consequences tell the behavior whether or not it should happen again. So if the door opens and we get outside to our car, then that consequence improved our life. It was successful. And so we're likely to turn the doorknob again the next time we want to get to our car. That consequence just happens to be called reinforcement. On the other hand, if we turn the doorknob and we run into a brick wall, then that consequence impeded our life. We're probably not going to turn that doorknob again the next time we want to get to the car. And so that is, like I said, the basic gist of that operant framework is that learning occurs based on what happens before and after the behavior. Now, the operant framework is pretty easy to understand, I think, when we think about simple behaviors like turning a doorknob. But in behavior analysis, or ABA, we can analyze even complicated skills based on that framework. We just have more complicated antecedents, more complicated behaviors, and more complicated consequences. So for example, there are a lot of antecedents that might trigger you to say the phrase chicken parmesan, right? One of those antecedents might be hungry, right? You want to eat something. You might need to be seated in an Italian restaurant. You might have to read chicken parmesan on the menu. There has to be a server in front of you. And maybe the server is turning towards you and asking, may I help you? Or do you want to order from me? So again, a lot of complex antecedents going on there. Lots of things must be in place for the phrase to be successful. But those things can still be considered antecedents within that operant framework. Okay, so that is the basic gist of what ABA is. It is, like I said, the science of teaching and learning. But I kind of also think it's important to discuss what ABA is not, especially because of what you brought up with some misunderstanding of what ABA might be. So ABA is not a specific treatment. Okay, it's not any particular specific treatment. And it's especially not a specific autism treatment. Again, it's the science, those principles that inform a variety of programs and interventions. In other words, a person doesn't get ABA the same way a person doesn't get cardiology, right? Cardiology is that broad science that informs a variety of treatments. And then ABA is a broad science that informs a variety of behavioral programs and interventions. In fact, it's been applied in a bunch of areas to improve performance and quality of life. Autism is definitely one of those areas, I think, that most people are familiar with, but also things like general education programs, health and fitness programs, environment and sustainability programs, substance abuse programs, mental health programs. And I think probably what's most relevant to this audience is it's been applied to speech and language programs. So speech and language pathology. SLP actually has a long history of being intertwined with applied behavior analysis. SLPs might be familiar with some terms that we use in applied behavior analysis. So they might be familiar with terms like prompting. And that's a strategy that stems from the science of ABA. And then any SLP who sets up communication temptations, so setting up the environment and ways to motivate individuals in ways they want to communicate. In my field, we tend to maybe put toys out of reach so that they want to request them. Those SLPs are manipulating antecedents in ways that are consistent with ABA programs. So SLPs might also be familiar with or hear about verbal behavior programming. Tammy kind of brought that up a little bit. And that is a broad behavioral method of analyzing and addressing communication. And then they might hear about more what we call manualized ABA-based communication intervention programs, things like pivotal response treatment. They might have heard of picture exchange communication system, incidental teaching. And I'm not sure if any of the SLPs have heard of the Lidcombe program, but that is a behavioral program for stuttering. So again, our field, I think, has a long history of being intertwined with ABA.
Thank you, Heather. Now I'd like to ask each of you, how did you get involved with ABA and how has it enhanced your skill set in SLP service delivery? Joanne?
Well, I went to The Ohio State University to get my master's in speech and hearing. And while I was there, I was working in a place called the Neisonger Center. And the purpose of the Neisonger Center was to create speech language pathologists, psychologists, special ed teachers, all of whom learned to collaborate with each other. But more importantly, we were being trained to work in the field of developmental disabilities. And my graduate advisor at the time said, if you're going to work in the field of developmental disabilities, you need to know a lot more than just language. And so I took a lot of independent studies and I took a lot of other courses. Some of the courses he had me take were in applied behavior analysis. So I had my own RAT and I trained him and I took a course on behavior management for kids with profound challenging behaviors. And I didn't find it in any way incompatible with my work as a speech language pathologist. Even then, I found that it was really supplemental. And when I graduated, I really wanted to work with kids with autism. That was my thing. So I moved to New York City and I looked for jobs and I found this one school. And this was 1982 when autism really wasn't, you know, it was one in 2,500 kids. So just to put that into perspective, it's one in 43 or something to that effect today. But there weren't many autism programs, and I found a job at this place called the Eden 2 School for Autistic Children. I took the job, even though it was the lowest paying of all that was offered, because my caseload would only be about 12 kids, and they were using this method called applied behavior analysis. At the time, it wasn't a very popular methodology. And so we went about our business, did our things, but I quickly learned how incredibly effective it allowed me to be in changing kids' behavior. Kids that were nonverbal, I was able to really help them develop speech. Because I had taken the coursework at Ohio State, I understood the principles of shaping and the schedules of reinforcement and all these things that I think were incredibly effective in my work. You know, for those of you that are going to go on and work with individuals with autism, I'll let you know right now that very few that you're going to work with won't challenge you in terms of being able to actually set up your intervention sessions to get things done. And the principles of behavior analysis really allow me to go into a session and arrange the contingencies and arrange the environment in such a way that I don't have the kind of behavior problems that others have with the same children, because I understand how to arrange things to reduce their need to engage in problem behavior. And so to me, that's one of the most important things that ABA has done for me, is it's allowed me to be effective with the population I work with. It's interesting because I was a speech pathologist for a long time, and then I eventually moved into director of school services. And because I moved out of actually direct service, I really wanted to stay in the world of speech language. So I went back and I got my PhD at the City University of New York. And while I was there, I really studied language acquisition from a very traditional linguistic and psycholinguistic perspective. And it's interesting because, you know, if you think about Skinner, he's got two really famous books. One is on verbal behavior, I believe called Verbal Behavior, and the other, some of my colleagues are going to have to remind me the exact name, but it's really about learning theory. And I can hold the two separate. I don't necessarily look at language in the same way that a behavior analyst might, but in no way does that conflict for me, because when you work with children with autism, there are kids with autism that don't acquire language. And Skinner's analysis of verbal behavior has always provided me with a framework when I know I'm going to have to teach language. But what's also been kind of fun is taking all this literature in my field, in the field of speech language pathology, and applying it in a behavioral way. Mariela and I had done a lot of presentations on ABA-SLP collaboration. And I always talk about the fact that for me, behavior analysis has become the train. It allows me to get from point A to point B with my learners. But speech language pathology and the content that I've learned in that arena has been helpful in contributing to the content of what goes in that train. So that's my perspective on ABA.
Thank you, Joanne. I guess I'm next here. Full disclosure, I am the oldest person on this panel. And so I will begin by telling you that I received my master's degree in the dark ages. I had only one course in language disorders, and it primarily addressed problems with vocabulary and syntax. In my first job after graduation, I served as an SLP in a school for children with multiple disabilities. Most of these children were nonverbal and somewhere on the autism spectrum. My phonology and syntax tools did not apply. But I did take some courses in behavior modification during my master's degree program. And Joanne, yes, I had a pigeon also. His name was Walter, but I digress. So I found that, you know, by applying what I had learned in behavior modification, which is what it was called then, I found that systematic reinforcement helped me to build a positive rapport with the children that I was working with, and that they would, in a sense, play with me during these sessions. I didn't try to teach syntax or phonology, but I had a good time interacting with them. Eventually, I returned to the university for a PhD with a focus on pre-linguistic communication development. And by the time I graduated, I had learned all about floor time, circles of communication, following a child's lead, setting up activity routines, using communicative temptations, and verbalizing a child's intentions. These are the strategies that I then used when I served as a consultant to families of children with ASD in Pennsylvania. One of my families had a 3-year-old nonverbal son with many challenging behaviors. I worked with him for 2 months using child-oriented strategies, the ones that I just described, and saw very few changes. This family later hired a behavioral consultant from California to organize a 40-hour-a-week home program, and I participated as a therapist in that program. During our very first team meeting, the behavioral consultant showed us how to use behavioral strategies to develop instructional control and how to create a therapy session that utilized a blend of structured and child-led procedures. From that point on, the child made amazing progress. I'm sure it's partly because he participated in 40 hours a week of therapy, but also because he had learned to collaborate as an interactive partner and not just as the leader of child-led activities. This inspired me to expand my education by learning about ABA and earning certification in behavior analysis. The skills that I learned not only applied to pre-linguistic communication, but also to the instructional design for targeting skills across all components of language. And equally importantly, the conceptual framework of applied behavior analysis helped me to analyze how to use the elements of learning theory to enhance instruction. As a professor at Westchester University, I've tried to integrate information about ABA within my courses on early intervention and language disorders, which are mostly based on a more traditional linguistic framework for language. And it's been challenging to do this, especially in the past few years, because of the misinformation about ABA that is projected on the internet by some members of the neurodiversity community. But we're working to find a common ground, so that's a good thing. Heather, tell us about your experiences in learning about and integrating ABA into your work.
Sure. Now, you know, Mariela, you might be the elder of the group, but I graduated in December 2005 with my master's in SLP, and I also did not get a lot of information about ABA. So even between all of that time, I got very little information about ABA from my graduate program. After graduating, I worked for a few years in school-based programs. And then it was around 2009, I began working in preschool programs for students with autism at the Chester County Intermediate Unit. So right here in Chester County. Even though I worked previously, I'd worked with students with language difficulties in the schools, so in elementary schools, I had never really worked with students who were nonverbal at the time. So I walked into that classroom. I was all excited to work with younger populations. I always wanted to work with younger populations. And I was faced with a population I never worked with before. So several of the students were nonverbal in the classroom. And several of the students engaged in some pretty severe challenging behaviors. And man, I really wanted to help those kids. But honestly, I was baffled about what to do. I had no idea where to start because I wasn't prepared to work with that population. In fact, I hope it's not advertised this way anymore, but I think I was in the tail end of the generation of SLPs where we were told that some children just plateaued and weren't going to learn anything new after a while. I don't know if any of my colleagues here have had been told that in their experiences, but I hope I was in the tail end of that generation that was told that. And man, that was just so depressing to me to be told that some students just weren't going to learn anymore. Now, I was very fortunate for starting at CCIU because one of the classrooms I worked in at CCIU got state consultation in ABA from the Patent Autism Initiative. So I explained before I used to work for them. I eventually worked for them because I was so appreciative of the impact that they had for me. I have to say I was very fortunate to get such thorough and accurate training in ABA through Patton.
Heather, can you tell us what Patton stands for?
Sure. Patton stands for the Pennsylvania Training and Technical Assistance Network.
Okay.
It is a state-funded organization. They have a variety of initiatives. So I believe there is also, I haven't looked recently, I now live in West Virginia, but I believe there is also an SLP initiative. They have a variety of initiatives. But the Autism Initiative was the specific patent initiative that actually went out to consult in public school classrooms that serve students with autism and to bring ABA into those classrooms, which is a phenomenal thing. And having lived in a variety of states now, I realize how fortunate Pennsylvania is to have such a thing. Because like I said, they give a thorough and really accurate training in ABA for anybody who wants it for free in public schools. So you asked how ABA enhanced my skills. And I think there were a few things I learned. First, and this was one of the first things I ever said about ABA, I thought it was a very positive science, meaning there's almost always something you can do. So there's no such thing as they're just going to plateau and can't learn. I was very attracted to that positivity. I was no longer told that there was nothing more we can do. In fact, there was always something we can do. So it really changed my perspective in a way that jived with my passion for helping individuals on the autism spectrum or anybody with disabilities. I learned the process of systematically teaching, and I don't think I can express that enough. So actually having a clear rhyme and reason for why I'm doing what I'm doing, other than, you know, something like, oh, this seemed to work before, or someone telling me to try it, or it's even more than I saw some research on this once. It's systematic teaching. I had tools in my toolbox as an SLP. I won't lie. I mean, I was fairly successful before I learned ABA. I had some tools in a toolbox, but not a clear system for how to select those tools, apply those tools, and then to objectively determine whether the tools were working. So I was more or less throwing procedures at the wall and seeing if they stuck with my students that I work with. And really ABA gave me that framework to systematically design, apply, and measure the effects of my practices. So that operant framework alone, I know I went into it a little bit in detail before, but that operant framework alone and the data analysis methods have had a huge impact for me as a professional in just my ability to systematically teach. And then like you, Mariela, I now incorporate the concepts and principles of ABA in most of my classwork. We talk about database decision-making that I learned from the field of ABA. We talk about the principles of ABA and treatment practices. So I owe my professional self right now to learning about applied behavior analysis and then being able to integrate it with speech language pathology.
Awesome. Thank you. Nikia, tell us about your background.
I graduated in 86 with my master's in speech and language and immediately started into a private practice. And we had clients that were very complex cases that nobody else knew what to do with. And even then, I didn't know what I was really doing with my complex cases. I knew what I was doing with my learning disabled kids, my straight up articulation kids. I knew that. But when it came to complex cases, I was really unsure about that. It was hard to go to conferences. There was no internet at the time. It was really difficult to kind of expand your scope, if you will, at that time, or I found it to be that way. And then one day, a private school approached me about contracting some speech and language services for them. It was a private residential school for children with autism. And I said, okay. And I learned that there were so many different faces of autism. And I learned that there were some kids that I was able to easily work with, others that I was very challenged to work with, just behaviorally as well as learning, having learning stick, if you will. And ABA was just a bad word at the time. Nobody wanted to do ABA at the school. They'd done it before. So they were into floor time. They were into facilitated communication at the time. And I just knew that could not be right. So I immediately went and got PECS trained that had some behavior analytic underpinnings. And most of the kids that I came back to the school to work with, I ended up implementing some pretty complex PECS systems with, and we did it to fidelity. It worked. Well, one day a little girl came from California and came with an IEP that had 5 hours of speech in it that had to be delivered by a behaviorally oriented speech and language pathologist. And that's how it was written in the IEP. And she got 40 hours of ABA a week in the IEP. And I did not even know what that meant, really, at the end of the day. So my local school system contracted me to do that service and to get trained in behavior analysis and teaching procedures. So I did. And I said, what they're doing is working with this little girl. So maybe I should dig a little bit more into this. So really, it was about the teaching procedures, how quickly the child was learning, shaping, data collection, fast-paced instruction, so on and so forth. So that's how I got introduced to it and decided that I would take a deeper dive in it, found out about verbal behavior, ABA, started to chase Vince Carbone around the United States, going to all the workshops that I could. And I really fell in love with ABA and learning how it was applicable to the full scope of what we did as speech pathologists. And it answered my questions as to why I was failing my students in some things because I wasn't teaching precisely. I wasn't fading properly. I was fading too fast, too slow. I was teaching targets incorrectly, out of a scope and sequence, and so on and so forth. So that's how I found ABA and applied it to practice. Started working with a lot of children with autism and became exclusively an autism speech and language pathologist for many, many, many years. And now I am applying behavior and analytic principles in my private practice with kids with speech and language disorders in a private academic setting. I work with very few kids on the spectrum anymore. So I've kind of morphed the whole spectrum and using a lot of behavior analysis across the board with all the clients that I serve.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Tammy.
You know, it's a really great listening to everyone's stories because they're very similar. I mean, we all share this story of having a desire to help individuals communicate, and then we witness the almost immediate effectiveness of ABA procedures. And then we know we have to be a speech pathologist and a behavior analyst within the same skin in order to provide the most effective intervention for these kids that are complex, that have complex communication needs, whether that's kids with autism or other kids that have multiple handicaps. They need both the lens of a behavior analyst and the lens of a speech language pathologist in order to have the most effective treatment. And it's interesting that we all kind of stumble into a situation that highlights that for us. And for me, I was an SLP, new graduate. I had new baby. I was so excited about working at this residential school. And I came in there and the first thing they taught us was about how you manage problem behavior. And so it was actually an excellent facility, and it was a baptism by fire in understanding the functions of problem behavior and understanding like that if you could figure out what function that problem behavior served, whether it was to get access to items or to get people attending to them or to get people walking away from them, if you understood that, then you could teach the right communication to replace that problem behavior. And even though this seems so simple when I'm saying it now, like to me, this was like life-changing. Like, oh, we're not just guessing or we're just not looking at what he's doing and then doing something in response to that. We're looking at what the behavior actually means for him and then giving him a better way of expressing that. So for most behavior analysts, this is like one of the basic things. But for me as a new speech pathologist, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. Like, how can these people figure this out? Like, so amazing, right? And I was amazed by that. And then, you know, I worked there for 3 years. And then every other job I had after that, because I had this background in dealing with kids with severe problem behavior, all the kids that had problem behavior got assigned to me. So my caseload was comprised of kids with problem behavior, disruptive behavior. And later, many of those kids, especially when I worked in pediatrics, those kids were later diagnosed with autism, because autism is a disorder of communication and social interaction. And if you don't have a good way of communicating, right, problem behavior works pretty good to get things you want coming towards you and things you don't want moving away from you. And what I loved about behavior analysis, and particularly when I started learning more about what not just the procedures that I saw, but the science, like Heather was talking about, the science of learning behind it, then I was like, oh my gosh, we can figure out how to fix these things by being very analytical and by really analyzing each unique person. And that was what I think was exciting. I wasn't looking at a medical diagnosis. I was looking at a person and their unique characteristics. I like to do what I'm trying to teach other people. I say, observe with wonderment, because you want to observe without judgment, to just look at someone in fascination and like see how their behavior developed and then what you can do to change that. So I was working at Bertha 3 Clinic, and like others, one of my kids on my caseload was one of the first kids to receive services through a LOVOS replication site, which was a giant ABA clinic. And I was really curious about this. And I was like, I'm going to go to the intro workshop. And in 3 days, they taught that child more than I had taught him in 3 months. And I said, I have got to learn about this. And I, like Marila, became a therapist on that child's case, in addition to being his speech language pathologist. And through that relationship, I started consulting to a LOVOS replication site and learned a lot about procedures. And then I met Vince, and then I started studying to become a behavior analyst. And that's when I really understood two things that were also life-altering for me. And one is that motivation doesn't dwell within an individual. Motivation is our responsibility. Like kids, it's not that kids are plateauing or they're not motivated. It's that I haven't figured out a way to contrive situations where they will be motivated. And that's on me. And it's also on me if I weaken their motivation by teaching things that are too hard or not in a systematic enough way. So those two, just understanding that made me a much better speech language pathologist. And, you know, this, you know, as I'm learning more and more as I get older, and believe me, you keep learning in this field, you're going to learn every week, if not, you know, every day, something new. Kids teach you, your colleagues teach you, across professions, colleagues will teach you. And this will be so essential for you continuing to learn and grow as a speech language pathologist, whether or not you choose to become a behavior analyst as well. But, that idea of like looking at each person as a unique individual and knowing what is of social significance to them, really listening and being with them, and that understanding communication is bi-directional, like Marila was saying, like, yes, I will follow your lead or use your lead to teach you. But also there are times when I'm going to be the instructor and you're a child, so you're going to follow my instructions, and that I'm going to do that in the most reinforcing and motivating way so that you can learn as quickly as possible. But you're going to require some of that assistance in order to learn. So I think those are probably the biggest things that I've learned. And my goal really for the last 30 years has been, I call it inspiring engagement and speech and conversation in individuals with autism, because I'm not trying to change anyone any their neurology, or all I'm trying to do is set up conditions under which they'll be inspired to learn, that they'll want to learn, so that they have more options in terms of what communication modality they can use, more options in terms of where they can communicate and with whom, right? Because that's always our role as a speech language pathologist, to have as much autonomy, right? So to be able to meet your wants and needs, and independence and choice making, right, for your life. So I really feel like my recent work, where I'm working with really the significant kids with significant complex communication needs, where I'm really working on contriving that motivation and noticing their subtle communication attempts and shaping those, and teaching other behavior analysts how to do that, and then how to layer more complex communication on top of that. This brings me so much joy, because just like I saw that first time when I saw that kid make that big change in 3 days, when I go to a clinic in 3 days, kids are changing and people are really inspired and excited. And it's because of speech pathology and behavior analysis. So I just want to inspire you today to learn as much as you can about behavior analysis and about working with other professionals, so we can continue to build the two fields together, because together we can do so much more.
Wow, Tammy, thank you so much for highlighting so many features of behavior analysis that can be combined with the SLP skill set to support engagement, interaction, and communication development among learners with even the most challenging profiles. And thank you to Joanne, Heather, and Nikia for your inspiring stories as well. Now, if you're a listener who is wondering what exactly it means for someone to be certified in behavior analysis, I'm about to tell you. Certification in behavior analysis is awarded by the Behavior Analysis Certification Board, or BACB. This board is independent of university training programs and independent of the two major professional associations for behavior analysts. The BACB awards two certifications to individuals with university degrees. These are known as the BCBA, which stands for Board Certified Behavior Analyst, and the BCABA, which stands for Board Certified Assistant Behavior Analyst. Professionals who have earned the BCBA can work independently, while those who have earned the BCABA must work under the periodic supervision of a professional with BCBA. The BACB also offers a credential for individuals without a university education who want to assist in behavioral programs. This credential is known as RBT, which stands for Registered Behavioral Technician. These individuals serve as paraprofessionals in behavior analysis, and they practice under the close ongoing supervision of a BCBA or BCABA. Now that you understand the range of credentials, I want to tell you some more detail about the requirements for earning the BCBA and the BCABA. There are four pathways to earning the BCBA. Each pathway involves three similar requirements. One, the person must have either a master's or a doctoral degree. Two, they must have a passing grade on the national certification exam. And three, they must complete at least 2,000 hours of supervised fieldwork in applied behavior analysis. These three pathways differ in how the educational content is acquired. In pathway one, the individual earns a master's degree or higher from a program that is accredited by one or both of the ABA professional associations. These associations are known as the APBA, which stands for Association for Professional Behavior Analysts, and the ABAI, which stands for Association for Behavior Analysis International. In pathway two, the individual earns a master's degree in a related field with degree equivalency coursework in behavior analysis at a qualifying institution. Not all universities have programs in behavior analysis. Some provide behavior analysis content under the umbrella of psychology or special education or another field. Degree equivalency is defined as 21 or more semester hours in six areas of behavior analysis. These areas include the BACB ethics code and code enforcement system, as well as professionalism. Second, philosophical underpinnings, including concepts and principles. Three, measurement, data display, and interpretation, as well as experimental design. Four, behavior assessment. Five, behavior change procedures, as well as selecting and implementing interventions. And number six, personnel supervision and management. In Pathway 3, the individual demonstrates relevant faculty teaching and research. This requires an acceptable graduate degree from a qualifying institution. Also, the individual must have at least 3 years of full-time work as a faculty member within a five-year period. And number three, the teaching responsibilities must include graduate-level courses on specific topics in behavior analysis. In Pathway 4, the individual must demonstrate relevant postdoctoral experience in ABA. This includes a doctoral degree from a qualifying institution, a postdoctoral experience with 10 years of full-time cumulative practice in behavior analysis. Some behavior analysts have a credential that is called BCBAD. Professionals with this credential have the same responsibilities and privileges of someone with BCBA without the D. However, the D indicates one of two achievements in addition to earning the BCBA. Either the person has earned a doctoral degree in behavior analysis from an ABAI accredited program, or they have earned a doctoral degree from a non-ABAI accredited program, and they have met one of three requirements. Requirement one is to pass at least 4 graduate level courses as part of their doctoral coursework. Requirement two, receive formal mentorship from a faculty member who held the BCBA and met supervisor qualifications. Or requirement three, author 2 published peer-reviewed journal articles that are behavior analytic in nature. A link to this information and other details about the BCBA is available in our show notes. Next, I want to tell you about the requirements for earning the BCABA credential. There are 2 pathways for eligibility. Each one requires the minimum of a bachelor's degree, behavior analytic course content, 1,300 hours of supervised fieldwork, and passing a national BCABA certification exam. The difference between the two pathways is that for pathway number one, the person must receive a bachelor's degree or higher from an ABAI accredited program. For pathway number two, the person's bachelor's degree must come from an accredited institution, and their degree program must include 19 hours of behavior analytic coursework in specific content areas related to behavior analysis. A link to this information and more is available in our show notes. Now I'm going to pass the baton to Nikia, who will tell us about SPABA.
Okay, SPABA is our acronym for Speech Pathology Applied Behavior Analysis, and we are a special interest group within the Association of Behavior Analysis International. SPABA was founded in 2005 by Dr. Barbara Esch. First annual meeting for the SIG was in 2005. Marila, Joanne, and Tammy were at that very first meeting. SPABA has always basically tried to mend that divide between speech pathologists and behavior analysts in our own little way. And it was really about trying to get speech pathology recognized within the ABA realm. We try to at least have a family, a close-knit community of speech pathologists and behavior analysts who can chit-chat about research that needs to be done, teaching procedures, and we find that SPABA does that well. SPABA's mission is to develop and disseminate empirically sound research, and IPP, interprofessional practice, is super important to SPABA, particularly between the two domains, between speech pathology and applied behavior analysis. We also are strongly believing the application of evidence-based practice that is relevant to the full range of services provided by speech pathologists and behavior analysts. And we've added to our mission this year is that we're really desperate to narrow that research to practice gap through education, training, and mentorship. So one of the things that we had initiated was to implement a FABA's community of practice event. So we did them quite frequently during COVID because, well, we were all on the computer during COVID. So we decided to do that as a way to continue to have our community. And now we put it into formal practice that every other month we have a scope event. It could be an AAC, it could be on matrix training, it could be on pseudoscience, it could be on critically reviewing Gestalt language processing, it could be on stimulus equivalence, direct instruction, anything that's relevant to speech pathologists and behavior analysts. And we have it open to anybody. It's free. It's a free 1 hour event. And people have been generous to donate their time and been presenting for us. We also have a significant social media presence. So for the young speech pathologists who are hopefully listening to this, please get on and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, X, and we are on LinkedIn. Most of our content gets pushed out at on all media outlets, but primarily it's Instagram and Facebook. It highlights research presentations by speech pathologists who are also board certified behavior analysts, as well as any behavior analytic research that relates to speech language communication and feeding. We also highlight speech and language literature that's relevant to our what we're doing as well that may have a behavior analytic twist. So we try to always highlight both. SPAVA also offers a yearly research application and dissemination grant to students and practitioners. So we strongly encourage people to apply for those. This year, there are $500 grants. One is for research projects. The other is for application project. And the third is for dissemination projects. Research projects are for students in either field or special education. It could be speech, ABA, special education, that would advance the evidence base or behavior analytic conceptualization for the treatment of speech language communication and feeding disorders. The application projects, we want them to involve the effective use of science-based principles of behavior by SLPs and encompassing research studies that will contribute to the science of ABA and reflect our mission at SPAVA. And dissemination project, we're looking for projects that facilitate cross-discipline dissemination of accurate information about speech pathology and behavior analysis so that we can continue to foster knowledge sharing and collaboration. Membership, you don't have to be a member of SPAVA. You can just join our community, our Facebook group community. There's no cost for that. If you'd like to be an official member, it's a $20 annual membership fee for professionals, $10 for students a year. We had up to almost 150 members 1 year, and this year we're up to maybe 60 for 2024, I believe. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much, Nikia, for sharing information about SPABA. A link to the SPABA website will be included in our show notes. And by the way, I understand that there are about 525 dually certified SLP BCBAs and SLP BCABAs across 43 states, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico, as well as 19 countries outside of the United States. So the population of unicorns is increasing every day. Before we go, I'm going to pass the baton to Joanne for a resource about ABA for SLPs that you might find useful.
So one thing I think we forgot to mention is that, you know, one of the issues that's always been kind of happening when those of us that are in the ABA SLP world do some public speaking and go to conferences, a lot of times the people that attend will ask, well, where can I get this information? You know, and everything is written by behavior analysts for behavior analysts. So we, Marila and I got together with a whole bunch of really smart SLPs and behavior analysts and edited a book called ABA for SLPs, A Guide to Intercollaboration for Autism Support Teams. And each chapter really helps describe the different components of applied behavior analysis. And the great thing is that each chapter was written by a behavior analyst and a speech language pathologist. So I think it's a really good place to go if you have questions about data collection procedures, behavior management strategies, curriculum development, and so on. So I encourage you to take a look at it.
Oh, Joanne, thank you so much for mentioning this book. We will definitely include the full reference in our show notes. Before we sign off, I want to share a reflection about our content. It concerns the science of ABA in contrast to intervention procedures based on the science. Remember Heather's analogy about cardiology? She said that you can't do cardiology because it's a huge science, but you can apply interventions based on cardiology. The same is true for ABA. You can't do ABA, but you can do ABA-based interventions. Unfortunately, we, the four of us, and our colleagues in the field, tend to say ABA as an abbreviation for ABA-based interventions. So if you heard us use that shorthand during our discussion, that is the explanation. We hope you will keep the distinction between the science of ABA and ABA-based interventions in your mind. Okay, next, I want to thank the members of this panel for sharing their time, knowledge, experiences, insights, and expertise about ABA in relation to SLP. I hope the listeners noticed our enthusiasm for the effectiveness of ABA-based interventions and for ABA-SLP collaboration. Finally, to our listeners, I want to thank you for the privilege of your time. We hope this podcast has clarified some concepts about the science of ABA, the value of ABA-based interventions, and the importance of ABA-SLP collaboration. And now, in honor of Westchester University, we wish you a ram-tastic day. Rams up! And now, in honor of Westchester University, we wish you a Ram-tastic day. Rams up.